Hello, listener. Welcome to the University of Maryland Extension presents the Garden Time Podcast, and we talk about getting down and dirty in your garden. We're your hosts. I'm Michaela.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Emily.
And today, we are talking about fall vegetable gardening with the University of Maryland Extension Home and Garden Information Center Director, John Tronfeld. So we're going to welcome John Tronfeld, a Principal Agent and Program Director of the fantastic Home and Garden Information Center. John is our vegetable specialist, and we're really excited to have him joining with us today. So John, tell us a little bit more about your work with Home and Garden and the University of Maryland.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me. I'm super excited to be on the Garden Time podcast. And am I correct in saying this is the 10th episode?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yes, it is. Yep.
Well, that's cause for celebration. That's pretty cool.
It is.
The Home and Garden Information Center is a statewide University of Maryland Extension program. We're here for all the residents, the renters, the homeowners, the community associations, schools, community gardens, master gardeners, anybody that does any kind of gardening or is just interested in what's going on outside. We are here for you. We have a great website, and we have a great blog called Maryland Grows that is really been focusing more on beginning gardeners this year, especially beginning vegetable gardeners, but we cover all the topics through the blog. We have a YouTube channel with over 200 videos, so lots of content for learning. Another service called Ask an Expert, and that's where we answer directly questions from any resident in the District of Columbia or Maryland. And it's a 24/7 service. People can attach up to 3 photos. And it's gone bonkers this year because of COVID-19.
I bet.
No surprise. Yeah. We had like a 65% increase between April and June this year compared to the same time last year. So keep those questions coming. We love it. We learn, you know, our staff learns this. People send questions. We see all kinds of new and interesting things. So, you know, we're just here for everybody. And last thing I'll say is I'm also involved with the Grow It, Eat It program, which is a big program of the Maryland Master Gardener program. It's one of the big sub programs. It started in 2009. And so I help support and educate master gardeners who go out and teach people across the state how to grow food, whether it's, you know, backyard garden, school garden, community garden. So it's been a real popular program. And again, because of COVID-19, a lot of new interest.
Awesome. Thank you, John. This is a free service that anyone in the state of Maryland can take you guys up on, right?
You bet. Free of charge.
Yeah.
If someone wanted to submit a question to the Ask an Expert, say they had an issue with a plant in their garden or a bug that they need help identifying, what kind of information would be really useful to you guys for them to add in with their question, just short of what is this?
Sure. Yeah, that's important because we're not there with you in the garden. You know, we're not face to face at a plant clinic where we can have a conversation. So it's really important that we know, you know, when did the problem start? What are the conditions in the garden around the plant if it is a plant problem? The more information, the better. And also, I'd say with photos, please. You know, we ask people to look and make sure the photos are in focus because then, you know, we're just going back and forth asking for better photos. But yeah, the more information people can share, the better it is for us in helping them to diagnose the problem.
That's a good question because that's information we ask from people as well when we get questions. So.
Oh, yeah.
So, John, you've been vegetable gardening probably a long time. Do you remember like your first experience that really got you into vegetable gardening?
Yeah, I've been doing it for over 40 years. I don't think I've missed a year. And for 5 of those years, I was also a commercial grower in Tennessee. But I guess my earliest memory or experience was with my dad. My family are city people. I grew up in Queens and we had a teeny tiny garden.
I didn't know that.
Maybe a half a dozen plants. Yeah. Yeah, you hear that heavy Queens accent that I have, for sure. Yeah, so I did a little bit of gardening with my dad, and I love it. For me, you know, my personal garden it's a peaceful place. It's an exciting place. There's always something to see and learn, and it means a lot to me.
You're still learning? We thought you knew everything.
Every year. That's the fun of it, isn't it? For all of us. True. We see new things here and learn new things. It changes your perspective. You know, the same plant grows differently in everybody's yard, it seems.
It's very true.
Doesn't it? You know, based on conditions. And more so with, you know, residential landscapes and gardens compared to farm fields where maybe the soil types are more similar over an area and the same crops are being grown, the same practices. But for us, you know, dealing with the homeowner questions and problems, there are so many additional factors that enter in. So it makes it challenging and fun.
So how do you think COVID-19 has contributed interest in food gardening in comparison to the 2008 economy crash? Because I feel like it's somewhat similar in how people are reacting to food gardening. But what is your take on that?
That's a good question. I think it's some of the same things. People want to try to save money. What's different, I guess, is people are home more in general, not everybody, but people maybe do have more time at home. And we're seeing that people seem to be just outside noticing things more because they're home. And that's been interesting. But I think both the 2008-9 recession and this COVID pandemic, people are maybe feeling like they want to get back to basics a little bit, connect more with nature. They want to maybe save money. They're interested in a safe food supply for themselves and their family. So all these things. And I think what we saw from the recession, last recession, was that people seemed to stick with it. We didn't see big drop-offs in food garden participation, at least the national surveys that we've looked at. So it will be interesting to see how things, you know, progress in terms of people being interested in growing their own food.
I think it also has to do with people feeling insecure about if they're going to be able to get their favorite tomato or, you know, cucumber or any of those little tiny things that you like to purchase in the grocery store, if it's going to actually be available. So growing your own food makes that source available all the time.
Yeah. And food apartheid is getting to be, you know, recognized more and more. And, you know, the need to make sure that everybody has access to land and food and to, you know, look at the historical record and see, you know, how did we get where we are and how can we change policies to make things more equitable?
John, can you go ahead and define food apartheid for our listeners who don't know that term?
Yeah, well, you know, just my limited understanding, I think a lot of food activists have been thinking that maybe the word food desert doesn't really capture the totality of, you know, racist policies that have led to the difference in accessibility to food for different groups of people in this country. So food apartheid helps to bring in the idea that it's policies, you know, over the years that have led to our current condition. So it's going to take policies to change it. We can't just say, well, people in certain communities don't have access to food. We have to ask why and what kinds of policies need to change so that that can also be changed.
No, that's cool. I hadn't heard that term yet and assumed it was along the same line. I know food desert is something that we don't use anymore because it doesn't always cover the topic. Because you'll go to places and they have access to food. It's just not like healthy food or a wide variety of food. So I know that there's numerous different terms popping up now instead.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't have any scientific reason to believe this, but I do think that you are much more likely to eat something you've grown versus something a little bit more detached from in the store. So there's definitely a lot of good thought to that.
Yeah, our SNAP Ed team has some data to show that particularly with kids, if they grow a vegetable, they're more inclined to eat that vegetable because they've, you know, put the time and the energy into it and the patience, and they're curious about it because they've spent that time doing it. So I can definitely see that. And I know when I was in grad school, we grew two rows of kohlrabi, and I will never buy kohlrabi because it's not something I like, but I learned how to cook it because I grew it.
So, yeah.
It's true.
It's the reason you don't find eggplant in my garden. I don't like it, so I don't.
And that's the most important part of vegetable gardening. If you don't like it, don't grow it.
That's right. Yeah, people forget that. Grow what you like to eat.
So this kind of goes back to the first question when we were asking you about your background in vegetable gardening. You say that you haven't missed a year in like 40 years. So what is the vegetable you absolutely have to grow? Like, what's your favorite?
Well, I hate to be so pedestrian as to say tomato, but tomato is my favorite crop. I go out and just prune and tie tomatoes just so I can be close to them. Some people hate the smell of tomatoes. I actually like the smell of the plants. So yeah, I'm tomato crazy.
You're among company, because I'm pretty sure we've had this conversation about, like, if we could have tomato-scented soaps and perfumes, we would all be wearing them.
I love the smell of tomatoes, but I hate the way they taste. So horrible.
No.
I know.
No.
I just, so weird. I can't get over the mushiness in the middle. Like, but I can do a fried green tomato. Like, you fry it, I'm going to eat it.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a variety or a cultivar that you are partial to?
You know, I've grown many, many different types of tomatoes over the years. For the past several years, I've been growing Supersonic, Jetstar, Better Boy pretty reliably. I grew Juliet for years, but I just have a hard time keeping up with those. Those are those small salad tomatoes that also I'm very partial to a tomato from Sicily that was the seeds were given to me by my wife's cousin's husband, Carmen. Shout out to Carmen. So yeah, mostly I used to grow a lot more heirlooms than I don't grow really hardly any heirloom. Now I grow more hybrids.
I've started growing the Jersey Devil this year as my paste tomato. I haven't grown that one before.
Yeah.
And that's just because I couldn't find any Romanos. So they have a really cool shape and I'm excited to see what they turn out to be like.
Yeah, yeah, let us know about that, Rachel. Yeah.
Yeah, the only one I grow is Sun Golds, but
I'm
doubtful that I'm going to get any this year because my toddler loves to pick the green ones, I tell her we have to. It's the hardest thing in the world is to wait for a tomato to turn color. So.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's funny.
My cucumber bed, I kind of let go rogue this year because I had some cherry tomato seeds pop up from last year. And the whole thing has been taken over by indigo blueberry tomatoes. And I actually went through and pruned out about 10 plants because I was like, I really don't need this many cherry tomatoes.
You know? I know. It takes a long time to pick them.
It does. So do you have a favorite fall vegetable that you always grow?
Well, I like broccoli rabe a lot. Everybody in our house likes it. So I try to grow that. I'll grow turnips and then garlic. And of course, we're not eating that in the fall, but planted it in the fall. And this year, I'm going to probably grow some spinach and arugula late and overwinter it. I've done that a few years, and it's just amazing how strong it comes back in the spring. I mean, the amount of leaf that you harvest is much greater than what you would harvest if you planted it in early spring. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Are you using cold frames or do you have like a greenhouse or something that you use?
No. I'll probably just use some of the lightweight row cover material that I have. It's the kind that lets in like 85% of light, and I'll just double it. So two thicknesses and throw it over the plants. I might use little hoops made from No. 9 wire. Some years I've just laid it on top of the plants. And they just seem to always come through. And it's amazing. So, you know, in early spring when people are starting seeds and wondering if they can get out in the garden, you just start to watch these plants come back to life that have overwintered and they really produce nicely.
Very cool.
So when you're thinking about your fall vegetable garden, do you start seeds or do you buy transplants?
Mostly seeds. And that's because, you know, when you're working, it's hard to take care of transplants, especially outside, if you're trying to grow them outside.
Mm-hmm.
This year I may try some transplants, but usually it's seed. And sometimes it just depends on how much energy I have at the end of the summer, you know, whether or not I'm even going to do much fall gardening and whether or not there's much space. I've been trying to use cover crops more in my garden. So I'm kind of more interested in seeing those grow than having the garden full of veggies.
What kind of cover crops are you trying to
Well,
grow?
I've been following University of Maryland Extension research projects, and I've been growing rye, hairy vetch, and crimson clover.
Oh, I love mixed. Crimson clover.
So do I.
Yeah, and some forage radish as well, you know, following the work of Ray Weil and his lab over the years. And, you know, between work and everything else, just too much. So this spring, there were two beds I just couldn't plant. So I put in Sudex, which is, you know, sorghum, Sudan grass cross, and then buckwheat. And I'm just letting those summer covers go and see how that works out.
Oh, nice.
That's very cool. Do you have to kill the cover crop, or do you get cold enough that it'll kill back some of that?
Yeah, well, no, I'll terminate it. And it's funny because in working with master gardeners and trying to talk more about no-till gardening, you know, people are interested in that. I'm trying it more and more at home. You know, we're just coming up with some pretty easy techniques, basically using a string trimmer to cut everything down to the ground and then smothering with, you know, weed barrier material or silage tarp or black plastic to actually totally kill the cover crop. So, you know, we don't have to use herbicides, because for winter cover crops, you know, when they come back in the spring, they can be difficult to manage, and that can turn people off.
Yeah.
So
that was my limited experience with cover crops, is that it was really hard to kill in the spring.
Yeah. And I'll tell you a funny story, a little anecdote. When Ray Weil used to challenge us, you know, if we said, well, we just have a garden, Ray, how are we going to use these cover crops? And he said, come on, you know, you guys just get those residues down. And then we'd say, well, how do you plant through the residues? He said, you just get a tire iron and you drag it through the residues. Oh, you could plant your beans and peas and use the bulb planter, you know, for transplants. So I think it's really the way to go, especially with climate change and trying to improve soil quality. So we're just trying to get that message. You know, farmers are following this now. We really want gardeners to start paying attention to the possibility of no-till in their vegetable gardens.
So what do you do to prepare your garden for the fall? Do you start making your plan in January about how you're going to get through the entire year, or do you just kind of wing it?
Rachel, let me tell you how it is, Rachel. This is one of those areas where I'm more of a do as I say person rather than do as I do, because I'm more of a winger. I wing it. I have a pretty rough garden plan that I put together, but it's not as detailed as it should be, you know, for me to get maximum benefit out of the garden. Mm-hmm. I try to make notes during the year, things I notice, you know, observations.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of have a sense of where there will be some spots for, you know, fall crops as we go through the season.
Mm-hmm. So I have a follow-up question. This is more of a personal question from me. For someone who's late in the game to vegetable gardening, is it too late to build a new bed and plant for fall?
Oh, no, not at all. No.
That's good
news
for me.
Go to it, Michaela. You're on, you're on notice now. Everybody's going to be asking you about your new bed.
Well, yeah.
So, John, what could get planted in a vegetable garden the first or second week in August?
We're really on the cusp where it's almost getting a little late for things like broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower. So probably be better to concentrate on leafy greens, even beets. Beets you could put in, but I'd say broccoli and all those kinds of cold crops that head up, they would need more time. So people are starting those really mid to end of July.
Okay.
So for Michaela, yeah, I'd say get it going. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to be a raised bed where you're bringing soil in or you're using existing soil.
It would have to be, because we're pretty dense clay.
Yeah.
It's pretty wet.
That makes it even easier. I mean, if you can get a nice mix of soil and compost or just use soilless mix and compost, then you'll be ready to go. And then depends what you like to eat. I mean, you can wait until then, the very beginning of September for, you know, lettuces and spinach and radishes, and carrots would go in August for fall harvest.
And Michaela, I've actually gotten my broccoli and Brussels sprouts to go until Thanksgiving on the Eastern Shore.
Okay. I was going to say we're a tad bit later just because it's a little bit warmer out here, but...
I've had Brussels sprouts out in my garden and or on the research farms until Christmas if we've had a mild winter.
Yeah. It really just depends on the weather. Right.
So I'm not a lost cause.
You're not a lost cause.
But you got to get them in early enough so they can make that growth during the warm part of the summer.
Yeah.
I was going to say, and, you know, another example of do as we say, not as we do. I don't know if I'd have time for a soil test, so it'd probably be experimental.
Yeah. I mean, if you're buying the soil compost mix, you can ask if they have a soil test report. They probably won't, but you're right. And we know that soil test is very important. But it's not always possible. Sometimes people just have to start gardening, and then they can soil test, you know, whenever it's possible for them to do it.
Do you have any recommendations for fall and winter vegetables that would be good for container gardening, John? For those of our listeners who may not necessarily have the space to have, like, an outdoor garden.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I've never grown beets in a container. I'm sure you can. I've seen carrots, beautiful carrots, grown in milk crates, plastic milk crates. So I don't see why you couldn't do beets as well. Any leafy green will grow fantastic in containers. You know, radishes, turnips. I love turnips. And that's another thing I'll be growing. And especially those fast maturing, I don't know if they're Japanese or Korean turnips, but there's some that will mature in like 30 days, and they're a very nice size. And, you know, as long as the container's deep enough, like 9-10 inches or deeper, those would do fine. But leafy greens in particular are super easy, you know, whether it's lettuces, Asian greens, kale, broccoli rabe, those types of things.
Are you going to try any new varieties this year? I always like to try one new variety of something every year.
I saw one new spinach variety called Giant Winter. It's from Fedco, and I might try it because they said it's supposed to really be good for overwintering. So I may try that one.
I'm writing that down as well.
Okay.
So do you have a favorite fall vegetable dish that you, like, religiously make?
Okay, so one would be sweet potato pie, which I love sweet potatoes, and shout out to sweet potatoes.
The undersold vegetable.
Oh my God, I love sweet potatoes.
I'm telling you, it's incredible. You can eat the leaves, the stems. And it's interesting, if you look at world history, it's been a crop that has saved people from, you know, hunger, from starvation in a number of countries. So it's a pretty cool crop. And it can really take the heat and take dry conditions. And again, something you should not do... But I've done it, and that is to use sweet potatoes from the supermarket in my area. And we warn people not to do that, of course. If there's any way possible, you should get your sweet potato slips from, you know, a grower who's certified. And I've taken a chance doing this, and so far I haven't had any problems with diseases. But I do grow Korean and Japanese sweet potatoes. And those make, they're drier in texture, and they make the best pie. And they're great for just, you know, baking in the oven. So I love that. And also, I've been growing this North Georgia Candy Roaster squash. It's Cucurbita maxima.
Ooh.
And I learned about it when I was living in Tennessee, but I never grew it. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I started growing it. I got the seeds from Southern Exposure Seed Exchange down in Virginia. And it's a really cool looking plant, large leaves. The fruits are very interesting in shape and color. And it really is, to me, one of the best winter squashes for baking or roasting. It's also easy to peel, easier than a butternut. So anyway, I really enjoy that particular squash, and I've been growing it every year.
The big question is, do squash bugs like it? Or is it resistant?
You know, it's funny. I start them late. So I don't start those seeds until mid to late June. And I don't put any cucurbits in early anymore for a lot of reasons. But one of them is our pest problems, like cucumber beetle, squash bug. So I plant my cucumbers late, my summer squash late, and this candy roaster late, like mid-June. And as a result, I see a few squash beetles, I get a few cucumber beetles, and just a few squash bugs. But it's been much more manageable growing that way.
I hate squash bugs. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, man.
Like, that's the biggest reason I can't do cucurbits.
I don't know what it is about them, but they give me the heebie-jeebies. I just can't do it. I hate them.
Well, when I was down with you all in Cambridge at that community garden, your MG showed me that great technique they had of wrapping duct tape around their hands, sticky side out, and they just went up and collected a whole lot of squash bugs.
Best tip ever. I give it to, it is. I share that tip with everybody.
Shout out to Dorchester County Metro.
That's right.
For
you
that
bet.
One. Yeah, I don't, see, they don't bother me at all. I don't even bother, like, I'll scrape the eggs off if they're there, but if not, I just let them go in my own garden. But I'm just feeding myself, so, like, I kind of let the bugs have my garden a lot of times.
Because you love bugs.
Yes, she does.
I do love bugs. I do have a funny sweet potato story. So I, a few years ago, bought ornamental sweet potato vines to plant in hanging baskets to look pretty, not realizing that they would, in fact, produce sweet potatoes. Like, I did not, I thought that they just looked similar and that they were not actually sweet potatoes. And they literally filled my entire hanging basket
with
sweet potatoes.
That's a nice surprise.
Did you eat them?
That is a nice surprise.
So, yeah, I did eat them.
So, John, I know we talked a little bit about squash bugs, and I know tomatoes have their own fair share of insect and disease issues. Are there any other safeguards you would recommend against insects, even just in the fall garden?
Well, row covers, I would say, would be the number one thing I would encourage people that are want to have a good vegetable garden and want to do it organically, have pest issues. I've had a lot of people over the years tell me what a difference it's made. In fact, we have some community gardens where once row covers were introduced by a few of the gardeners, all of a sudden you go out there and every garden has row cover material. It's just very effective at excluding pests. You know, it also can hasten growth in the spring, protect the plants, you know, through frost. So that's a great thing to use. Another thing I would say is just the monitoring, you know, just learning. Number one, IPM principles, of course, integrated pest management. So, you know, getting out in the garden, being able to identify what are the major pests, what are the minor pests or insects that really people don't need to worry about. But sometimes people will go out and spray their plants just because they see an insect on it. So we really try to get people to stop doing that and understand, you know, which are the most serious pests? How can you prevent the problems? You know, I mentioned what I've been doing, planting cucurbits later. That's helped me in that regard. So those are some of the big things. Hand picking, you know, really get out in the garden on your hands and knees, flip the leaves over, look for those egg masses. We have some great videos with Mike Raup showing people how to do that in the garden. I think, you know, you just learn over time. There are some soft organic pesticides that people can use where it's warranted, but you can definitely grow a very productive vegetable garden without synthetic pesticides.
Very cool. So with the row cover, are you leaving that on all the time or do you take it off during the day or night?
You know, it depends. So for in the spring, for most spring crops, people can leave it on through the life cycle of that plant.
Okay.
You know, for leafy greens or even things like broccoli. Of course, we know with the family that requires cross-pollination to form fruits, so cucumber, squash, melon, we're going to have to pull the cover off when the plants start to bloom. And even with eggplant, there's some cross-pollination that takes place that'll increase yield. So, and that's another plant. I know you don't like eggplant, Emily. I love eggplant. So we leave it on, you know, until the plant starts to bloom because the flea beetles can really be tough. So late in the year, flea beetles, again, can be really tough on members of the cabbage family. So the row cover can come in really handy.
That's a great tip.
Yeah, that is a great tip.
Here's our plug for the Home and Garden Information Center webpage. There's a ton of information about growing specific kinds of vegetables on that webpage. It's just like a wealth of resources. You know, there are fertilizing requirements, the recommended varieties. there's anything else you have to add to that, John.
Yeah, we have a common problems button on our vegetable page. So you can see, you know, divided by insect pests and mite pests, diseases, and environmental problems. So if you click through, you can see a lot of the common problems. And I'm a little embarrassed to say that, you know, even though Grow and Eat, it's been very popular, some of our web pages really need to be revised. And we're going to be working hard on that this fall and winter. And so I'm always open to suggestions if people see things that are missing or that they would like to see added or need to be revised, let us know, you know. And also, the Maryland Grows blog has a whole food gardening section to it. Erica Smith, who's a master gardener in Montgomery County and was the coordinator for our old Grow It Eat It blog, she blogs monthly. I have a monthly article. So we have lots of good articles. So just check us out.
So the webpage for that is marylandgrows.umd.edu, and that's the blog. And the URL for the Home and Garden Information Center webpage is extension.umd.edu/HGIC. Well, a huge thanks to John for taking the time to come on today and chat with us a lot about vegetables.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, it was my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. This was very exciting.
Get your tip of the month here with Rachel.
So, Rachel, do you have any garden tips for us this month?
I sure do. It's August. It's hot. And I know that John gave us a lot of tips about ways to get our vegetable gardens ready for the fall season, but here are some tips to get your summer crops going a little bit longer. You need to keep watering and weeding that vegetable garden and your shrubs and perennials. August is notorious for being dry and hot, and we want to make sure that our plants are keeping those nice, healthy root systems. So you can plant a late crop of basil, cilantro, and dill. If your cilantro is already flowered, then you now have some coriander seeds. Woo, woo! Harvest leaves of your herbs before they flower. And you want to pick those individually and dry indoors, or you can hang the stems in a dry, semi-shady room. Store the dried leaves in an airtight jar. So that's a great thing to do with your basil. Or you could also chop up your basil, mix it with some olive oil, and throw it in those individual ice cube trays. That's a good way to store it for winter use. It's time to order your garlic, your walking onions, or your shallots for fall planting. And you want to also make sure that you have a bed or a spot reserved in your garden to plant those, because they're going to be in there for a while. Also, remove any diseased plants. So this is when you're going to see squash vine borer or tomato early blight or late blight. You want to take out any of those plants that look diseased. And don't just take them out and discard them in your compost pile. Take them out. Put them in a black trash bag, tie it up, and let them bake in the sun for a couple of days, and then get rid of them. If you have any diseased tomato plants, you want to make sure that when you take out your tomato cages in the fall, that you are disinfecting those for the next season. August is a frequent dry month. If you planted any new trees, shrubs, or perennials, you need to keep watering those and allow the water to soak into the surrounding soil and the root ball. I would hook up a soaker hose, or if it's a tree, you could actually get the water bags and hook it to the tree. Or you could also just drill a hole in a 5-gallon bucket and fill up the 5-gallon bucket and put it next to the tree. That's a good way to, you know, slowly let water in. I wouldn't sit there with my sprinkler and let it go for a few hours, because then you're getting water on the leaves of the plant. You know, you can create some fungal issues if you're doing it that way. You're going to see a lot of caterpillars out in August, such as the orange-striped oakworm or the green-striped maple worm. Oak skeletonizer sawflies are feeding on various shade trees, but you don't need to worry about spraying anything. The only thing, if you see a saddleback caterpillar or other stinging caterpillars, leave them be. Do not touch them. August is prime time for our puss moth caterpillar. And they are blonde, fuzzy caterpillars. They're almost like the woolly bears, but exaggerated 10 times. They almost look like a really bad toupee. Do not touch these. Kids love to pick them up because they look like woolly bears and they have very, very venomous stings. If you happen to touch it and you do have an allergic reaction, you want to make sure that you seek medical attention. So summer turf care. Tall fescue lawns will go dormant during this weather. So they will green up when the temperature is cooler. So you don't need to irrigate them. You also want to make sure that you're not mowing your lawn during this time, since mowing wounds grass blades and can allow for plant moisture to escape. Don't mow it if it's not growing. You also never want to fertilize turf grass during the summer. Wait until September. If you're planning to do a lawn renovation project in the fall, wait to do your reseeding at that time. Now is a great time to take a soil sample and do a soil test. Check out our April 2020 episode, part one, where we talk to Dr. Nicole Fiorellino about soil health and why it's important to do a soil test. We also have the Home and Garden Information Center fact sheet 110 that goes into soil test basics. That is a great reference as well. That's all I have for our tips of the month.
What's buzzing? It's the bug of the month with Emily. So this month's bug of the month is not actually an insect. This month's bug of the month is the two-spotted spider mite. This is the one that kind of loves the hot, dry weather. So August is a prime time to see it starting to appear in your garden, or in my case, you have a container garden like on your front porch or something like that. It loves those kinds of environments. So again, they are not insects. They are a mite, so they're more closely related to ticks and spiders. They're a type of arachnid. They are very tiny. The adult spider mites will be about 2 millimeters in size. They have one body segment that's more sac-like, so they lack a distinct head, and they will have 8 legs during their adult stage, but during their younger stages will have 4 and then 6. This mite has 2 dark spots on its back. The adults will overwinter on plant debris or under bark and will have multiple generations per year. During the heat of summer, they can do their complete life cycle, so egg to nymph to larvae to adult, in as little as 7 to 8 days. So if you have these on your plants and you come back a week later, their population can literally double. So they will use their piercing sucking mouth parts to remove the contents from individual cells, leaving behind only the cell wall. So this will give your plant a silvery white stippling-like look to it. Heavy infestations will turn a faded yellow and or grayish color. One of the first things that people tend to notice when they have spider mites, however, is that there'll be a thin layer of webbing. And this is where they actually get their name, spider mites, from, because they're mites, but they make this webbing. And this is created by a large number of mites. You can normally, if you look at it, you might see the adult mites walking across it, or you might see like poop or frass or dust that's been caught up in them as well. You will normally need a hand lens in order to see the adult mites because, again, they're rather small. I tend to find spider mites in my vegetable garden a lot on my cucurbits. So specifically if you are doing things like cucumbers, pumpkins, squash, and watermelons, they tend to appear a lot on these. Occasionally you will find them on other vegetable plants. I know some people have found them on things like eggplants and peppers, tomatoes, and so forth if the infestation gets bad. So what you can do is if you do start to see these appearing on any of your plants is, first and foremost, you want to reduce your plant stress through proper watering and fertilizing practice. This will make it so that the plants can actually outgrow the spider mite damage. And you want to make sure that you are not excessively fertilizing, because what will happen is that just gives the spider mites additional nutrition and the population will end up exploding because of that. So really make sure that you're following proper fertilization rules. So a small outbreak can easily be handled just with a stream of water or hosing down of those plants. And depending on what plants you are working with and its life stage will depend on how heavy of you know, stream of water you want. So you don't want to damage the plant, but you definitely kind of want to give it a good wash down. And I recommend doing this early in the morning so that the plant has all day to dry. Ideally, again, we want to reduce any possibility of diseases happening, but because these mites are so small, the water will easily wash them off the plant and they'll have a hard time getting back onto the plant. There are also several species of predatorial spider mites that you can buy commercially and release out into your garden. And these will just come as little packets or little containers that you can poke holes in and then put them there. Spider mites are so small that a lot of our predatory insects don't really feed on them. So like ladybird beetles and lacewing larvae, while they may occasionally eat them, are going to go after aphids a lot more than spider mites. So if you do want to do kind of biocontrol, you really need to look into getting predatory spider mites to combat these versus just kind of our natural enemy insects to do it. You can use chemical insecticides. However, you want to be cautious that you need to get the entire plant, particularly the top and the underside of the leaves, in order to really combat spider mites. And honestly, as we move into the heat of summer, I would discourage people from using a lot of these commercial ones because you may end up burning the plant more so than getting rid of the mites. I know particularly things like horticulture oils and any chemical that needs anything like a surfactant or a sticking agent mixed in, those are all petroleum-based, so you will also fry your plants. So I recommend just using the stream of water from your hose or watering can to the best of your ability. You can use oils during the dormant season to control the overwintering forms. However, you do not want to apply horticultural oils to blue spruce trees. They are particularly sensitive to oils and to potential burn because of oils. So potentially use an insecticidal soap instead if you have blue spruce trees. You can also prune out areas. So if it's only like one section of your tomato plant that seems to be heavy with them, just prune that section out. It's okay. And that's all I've got for spider mites.
It's the Native Plants of the Month with Michaela.
So my choice this month is a little bit obscure. I'm not sure if you guys have heard of it or seen it before, but it's called jewelweed. And the scientific name is Impatiens capensis. And you may have picked up the fact that it is our native impatiens. And however, that's where the relationship to the commercial variety really stops, because they don't look anything alike, except that they are also an annual. So they don't necessarily overwinter, but they self-seed very freely. So it almost has the appearance as though they're perennial. But a small flower is orange and it's spotted, but the foliage is a very light green and it's super succulent. And that's the best way I can use to describe it, because, you know, some perennials have like almost a woody stem, but this is the exact opposite. So it's really pliable. And they love the shade and they form these really dense groves in the right locations. And it's great for under like spice bush or some other of those understory bottomland trees that kind of like moist soils. And unlike many of the other native plant choices, like I said, this is an annual, so it self-seeds very freely if you let it go. And this has kind of a competitive behavior, which is great because I think that makes it an excellent competitor for invasive annuals like garlic mustard and Japanese stiltgrass, which also grow in very similar environments. So if you can get the native impatiens to kind of establish, you have a good chance of outcompeting those invasive plants.
It's a really cute little flower. I really love it.
It's so beautiful. Cute. That's why I had to make it my plant of the month, because it's very cute.
It kind of so it's got very orchid looking in the front, but then it kind of reminds me of like Jack and the Poppet, because it's got like a little pouch butt to it.
Yes. If I'm looking at it's kind of cool because you don't see orange very often in native plants. I think butterfly weed is the only one I can really think of off the top of my head.
Yeah.
So it's a very pretty color. So it's got a pretty unique flower, and from what we know is that it's primarily pollinated by bumblebees and even hummingbirds. So that's another incentive why you might want to include this for a nice location in your garden. And it has a lot of historical use in Native American medicines, but I'm not going to get into that. I don't know a lot about it. But there have been studies done by NIH about using it as a remedy for itching from stinging nettles, poison ivy, and hives.
Oh, neat.
So it's not more effective than soap, but it does have some effectiveness. So if you were in a pinch, and often sometimes that poison ivy and the impatiens, they will grow together, like in the same environments. So if you know you've gotten into poison ivy and there are the jewelweed is right there, you might be able to kind of remediate some of that itching before it even begins. I used it as a kid for poison ivy, but I wasn't very susceptible back then. And so I don't know if it works, but there have been studies done about it and it does have some qualities to prevent that itching. So it's kind of a cool plant. And you know, I love multifaceted plants that have multi-purpose use. So that is why this is my pick of the month. Well, that's all we have for this episode, listener. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll tune in next month for more gardening tips. If you have any garden-related questions, please email us at umegardenpodcast@gmail.com, or you can look us up on Facebook at Garden Time Podcast. That's Garden THYME Podcast.
For more information about the University of Maryland Extension and these topics, please check out University of Maryland Extension Home and Garden Information website at extension.umd.edu/HGIC.
Thanks for listening and have fun getting down and dirty in your garden.
Goodbye! The Garden Time Podcast is brought to you by the University of Maryland Extension. Michaela Boley, Senior Agent for Horticulture in Talbot County, Rachel Rhodes, Agent Associate for Horticulture in Queen Anne's County, and Emily Zobel, Senior Agent Associate for Agriculture in Dorchester County.
University programs, activities, and facilities are available to all without regard to race, color, sex, gender identity or expression, sexual orientation, marital status, age, national origin, political affiliation, physical or mental disability, religion, protected veteran status, genetic information, personal appearance, or any other legally protected class.
John, was that your dog just shaking, or was that...
That was mine, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, I heard that, yeah.
I was like, wait a minute, we're going to need to see this right now.
My cat made an appearance, and I won't see them all day, but as soon as I'm on my computer and like on a chat, yeah. They all come out of the woodwork. I don't know what they're doing.
That's funny.
They're the best.